Hey, we're jumping into session 6 in your notebooks on this session called Resolving Conflict, which we're actually calling Maintaining Oneness in Marriage. No kidding, that's actually not just a positive spin on conflict. That actually can be a present reality. So resolving conflict can actually be how we begin to maintain oneness in marriage. And it's not just always the big things that create conflicts in marriage, is it? It's not just forgetting the anniversary. I mean, that becomes the poster child for the big thing. But more often than that, we have 364 days a year that gives us tons of opportunities to have conflict in our homes, right? Hey, Today's Woman magazine was doing research on the top 6 marital conflicts. And I remember coming across that article. And by the way, if anybody right now is having the thought, what are you doing reading Today's Woman magazine? I don't ask you what you read. Why don't you back off, okay? It's none of your business. I'll stay out of your business. You stay out of mine, all right? But what do you think number 1 was on the list? Top conflict in a marriage. What do you think it is? Yeah, how is it that we always know exactly what it is? It's money, right? I mean, they don't tell us what they mean by that. So Today's Woman doesn't expound on that, but I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to tell you, I don't think what they mean is too much money is creating conflict in your marriage. Like, honey, the money's piling up in the kitchen. It was your turn to spend it. I tripped twice on it this morning. No, we know exactly what they mean when they talk about money, right? In fact, here's the rest of the list on Today's Woman magazine. You'll see that the first one is money. The second one is lack of communication. The third one is a lack of time. Fourth one is parenting issues. Fifth one is sex. Again, I'm going to go out on a limb, and they're not arguing about who has too much sex, okay? And then the sixth one, they said, is in-laws. Well, Relevant magazine, a Christian magazine, turned around and did another piece of research, and they came up with the same topics on the list. Money, sex, work, parenting issues, and then the daily grind of household chores or housework. What does that tell us, men and women? You know what it tells us? Conflict is common to how many marriages? All. Yeah, and you fit in the description of all marriages, and so do I. Because if it isn't me, is it money, communication, time, parenting, sex, in-laws? That pretty much covers everything we tend to talk about as couples, doesn't it? So conflict is common to all marriages. Or if you want to say it the way the Apostle Paul says it, he says, no temptation has overcome you that is not common to all other men. In other words, the stuff you deal with is the same stuff your neighbors deal with. True, some of it to different degrees, but they're going to have to navigate conflict. You're going to have to learn to navigate conflict as well. So for us, the issue is not, the goal in marriage is never, ever to be conflict-free. The goal in marriage is to handle conflict correctly or handle it healthily in a way that it can actually become an ally to building oneness in your relationship. And indeed it can be. What we call conflict, God sometimes calls a tool to remake us into that image of oneness. In fact, couples with no conflict, they struggle with shallowness in their relationship. And couples with conflict that's handled poorly, well, they struggle with bitterness in their relationship. But couples that resolve, or let's say it this way, who resolve conflict, well, those are the deepest, richest, most textured couples that you've ever seen. And so what would it mean for us to do conflict in a way that actually builds oneness rather than creating isolation in our marriages? And for this session, I'm going to tell you, the model that we'll use is taken from a man named Gary Rosberg. Gary Rosberg was an associate of mine, a colleague of mine, and we were teaching at a marriage conference a whole bunch of years ago together. And I said, Gary, what are you working on now that stimulates you the most? He was a marriage counselor at the time. And he said, well, after thousands of hours of doing marriage counseling, I've started noticing patterns between healthy and unhealthy couples. He said, I'll have couples who are unhealthy, who walk through what I call a conflict loop, but they never bring it around and close that conflict loop. And because of that, they leave all these conflicts open in their relationship, and it just seems to erode the oneness that they're trying to experience. He said, on the other hand, I'll have couples that experience huge breaks and violation in their relationship. But if they will choose to walk the process and close what he called the loop on that conflict, he said, these couples always grow in oneness. He ended up writing a book on that called Choosing to Love Again. And this conflict loop is part of what he describes in that book. We're going to walk through a conflict loop in a healthy way, because many of us have seen so many open conflict loops that we need to find out what it looks like to close the loop. If you leave too many conflict loops open, you're going to find that even the next small infraction in your relationship, it causes a disproportionate reaction of anger and hurt feelings. And you think, what is that? Did you just marry the pettiest person on the planet? No. You have a relationship with so many open conflict loops that any small infraction creates a mountain of pain as a result. So let's do this. Let's imagine that actual conflict occurs in your relationship and an offense has been committed. So let's be fair, okay? That's too threatening to talk about your relationship. Let's talk about my relationship. Let's say that my relationship, Mark and Lisa's marriage, has an offense that's happened. And to be fair, Lisa probably started it, okay? So Lisa has done something and an issue has now been started in our relationship. Our tendency is first of all to say, I know exactly where the problem in this conflict is, and the problem is with you, right? But James turns around and he says, I want to give you a better set of eyes. And so he asks this question in James chapter 4, verse 1. He says, what causes fights and quarrels among you? That's a great question, James. She did. He did. And then he answers the very question he just asked me. And he says, don't those fights and quarrels come from your desires that battle where? Within you. And the first thing we need to see is where the conflict is. And the trouble is not so much always in our spouse or in our marriage. The trouble is closer to home. Something is going on within us. And we've got to start by turning in and looking here first. So what's going on in us? Well, after an offense happens, the next response that you will feel, that I will feel when we're offended, is anger. And anger is the second thing that happens in a conflict loop. Anger itself is not sin. God feels anger, and God knows no sin. In fact, Ephesians chapter 4 tells us that anger itself is not sin. Ephesians 4:26 says, in your anger, do not sin. And do not let the sun go down while you're still angry, and do not give the devil a foothold. Ephesians 4 actually commands us to be angry. Isn't that amazing? Be angry, yet do not sin. Again, my associate, my colleague, Dan Allender, we were once in a meeting together, and he said, I don't think the issue is that Christians get too angry. He says, I think the issue is that Christians don't get angry enough at the right things. You think about it, he's got a point. Like, I get more angry at a fast food order that hasn't been filled right for me than I do that there are 20 million people trapped in human trafficking right now. Something's out of whack there, isn't it? Yeah, we don't have to realize that anger itself is not the problem. But how we deal with anger, what's behind the anger, that's the issue we've got to deal with. Folks, we all get angry. Again, anger is a God-created, God-given emotion. We just do anger differently. Some of us stuff anger. You're the kinds that tend to do the silent treatment. You've worked hard and perfected the art of avoiding conflict. You can even tell your spouse you're not angry in that way that everybody in the house knows you're angry, which is why they stop talking too, right? Others turn around and deal with anger in a totally different way. You don't stuff anger at all. You blow anger. It's just game on. Conflict happened. All right, let's go. Let's jump into this thing. Let's talk it through. Some avoid, some attack. Any avoiders and attackers actually find each other on planet Earth and then pledge to live with each other for the rest of your life? Were you crazy? Yeah, Lisa came from a long line of conflict avoiders, anger stuffers. We dated in high school. You could tell exactly how her parents were doing by the length of silent treatment they gave. My family, on the other hand, you just aired it out. I grew up with all brothers. It just was all out there on Front Street. Okay, you just might as well open up a shop that says, I'm angry.com, right? And so you have a guy who attacks in conflict and a woman who avoids in conflict, and they get married and live in a small 600 square foot studio apartment where she's avoiding and he's attacking. Now in Arkansas, they call that hunting, not resolving conflict, okay? And that's what she felt. She felt hunted, and I felt neglected. And guess what happened? The conflict just intensified. All because we didn't know how to deal with the anger that was really going on. Anger is a secondary emotion. That means that we feel angry because we already have felt hurt or felt fear or felt frustration. So when you feel hurt, fear, or frustration, the surface emotion you feel is anger. That's the only way you can explain why a mother who loses a small child in a Walmart supercenter can be panicked with fear. And then when they finally find that child, they hug that child so tight and then stick them out here and shake them and shout at them right afterwards. That anger is just a manifestation, a secondary emotion that's coming after the fear. Anger's like the red light on your dashboard. Right? You have never, hopefully, driven a car to your mechanic and said, hey, I got this red light that just came on. Just need you to turn that off and we'll be good. No, you know that red light on the dashboard is there to tell you, pop the hood and find out what's going on underneath, right? And so it is with us. By the way, that's not my idea of how to deal with anger. That's God's idea. The first angry young man who walked the planet right after the fall, his name is Cain. He's enraged with jealousy. He's hurt. And he's jealous over his brother Abel. And God sees what's in his heart, and he moves in to father that boy and to coach him. And the first thing he does, he doesn't say, boy, you better stop being angry and put a smile on that face. Instead, in Genesis chapter 4, what does he say? Cain, what's the next word? Why are you angry? Now here, if the Heavenly Father is coaching Cain's angry heart that way, don't you think he might be doing that to show us how we should deal with anger too? Honey, you look grumpy again. You need to stop being so grumpy around the kitchen. Or we could take an approach like God. Honey, why are you angry? What's going on that's the primary emotion driving that? Or, in my own case for me, Mark, why are you angry? Let's find out if there's hurt or sadness or frustration going on underneath. And see, if we don't deal with that well, in our anger, we can choose to bail out and leave a conflict loop half open. And once we bail out and you see that conflict loop with the curly Q going out, let's pull that next slide, Corey. That leads to unresolved conflict. Now, momentarily, you might get yourself some peace. You might enjoy the fact that we didn't have another argument tonight. But you've left a conflict loop open that will come up again in some way. Too many open loops will erode oneness. And what's left is we'll have a stony silence for a marriage. Or worse than that, we'll have a hostility or a bitterness that has crept in. Listen, when conflict occurs, you feel the anger. Treat anger like a messenger. Don't shoot the messenger. Ask what the messenger is trying to tell you. What's going on in your heart or your spouse's heart? And once you do that, you're prepared to move to the next place on the conflict loop, loving confrontation. Loving confrontation. And the first thing we have to do is decide if the conflict needs to be confronted. Because the Bible actually gives two ways, two very good biblical ways for us to deal with conflict with each other. And one of them is actually just to overlook it. In fact, it's Proverbs 19:11 that says, "Good sense makes one slow to anger, and it's his glory to do what? Overlook that offense." Gary Oliver was talking to myself and Chip Jackson one afternoon, and he made this offhanded comment. He said, "Of course, in all marriages, you know that as you do pastoral counseling, about 80% of all marital conflict cannot be resolved." To which Chip and I wisely responded back to him, "Oh? Really? I'm a married guy. That might be important to know." And I said, "Gary, what do you mean by that?" He said, "Think about it, Mark. So much conflict that's created in our marriage is not really a matter of right or wrong. It's just a difference of perspective or a difference of opinion. Lisa happens to manage her time extremely well. She's 5 minutes early everywhere she goes. She happened to marry a man who believes if you're 5 minutes early anywhere, that's poor stewardship. Of 5 minutes, you could have gotten one more thing done." Okay? And we're going to approach things differently. Now, we could sit there and lobby to each other who's more right and who's more wrong, or we could choose to learn to manage the differences. Sometimes you can't just manage by overlooking. Sometimes you have to manage by actually talking it through and doing what we see on there called loving confrontation. How do you do loving confrontation? Well, Galatians 6:1 says, "Brothers and sisters, if someone is caught in a sin," I love this verse. Translate it this way. "If your spouse has blown it," okay? "You who live by the Spirit," so you who's clean on this one, "you who live by the Spirit should restore that person gently." Why? You need to watch yourselves too, or you also may be tempted. So we do all loving confrontation starting with a heart check. Galatians 6 says it's grounded in humility. I know what it's like to be frail. I really shouldn't be surprised that my wife falls down. In fact, Ecclesiastes 2 says, two are better than one. A lot of you use that as marriage verses on your wedding invitations. Two are better than one, for when one falls down, there's another there to pick him up. That sounds so romantic. That's not romantic. That's real life. That just says somebody's going to be falling down all the time in your marriage. Quit complaining that you're there to pick them up. Why do you think you're just see job security? You have job security, okay? Now, how do you move in with your spouse in the area of conflict? You move humbly. Do you want your marriage to be a divine portrait? Well, if we do, we better be prepared for Jesus to speak into it. I mean, just think of Jesus' teaching, Sermon on the Mount. He says, "Hey, I've got this scenario. Let's say, Mark, you're married to this woman named Lisa, and there's a conflict going on. What I want you to do is I want you to pull the log out of your own eye first, and then you can go over here and help her pull the splinter out." And I just go, "Time out, Jesus, right here. Because it seems to me, and I got a pretty up-close view of this marriage, it seems to me she's got the log. In fact, she's got this telephone pole sticking out of her face, and she's been whacking me with it all day long, and I'm the one who's picked up the splinter. Why do you assume I've got the log and she's got the splinter?" And that's Jesus' point exactly. The biggest issue I'm most passionate to deal with in conflict is my issue. Because he's going to turn around and talk to Lisa the same way and say, "Sweetheart, I want you to believe that you've got the log, that it's the biggest issue in your marriage. And if you'll embrace that in humility, well, then you can move in a way that actually restores oneness." The biggest sin we see in all of our conflict that we've got to be most passionate about is our own sin and where we've fallen short. You ever have one of those parenting moves that you do with your kids that they don't get at all, but it seems to really help you? I still remember the Sunday afternoon, our four oldest, close together in age. We had four within 6 years. And the two boys who were in the middle lived in the same bedroom that was right above the dining room. They always wrestled a lot and played a lot in their rooms, which is fine. The house wasn't super well built, so the chandelier in the dining room would move a little bit when they horsed around. But sometimes you could tell when push got to shove because that chandelier would just be swinging. So one Sunday afternoon, Lisa said, "You better go up there." And I'm like, "Me? They're scared of you. You should go up there." And I turn and I start walking up the stairs. It's 12 short steps to their bedroom. And I'm walking up the stairs and I'm having this super fast dialogue in my mind. I'm going to walk up here. I'm going to enter their bedroom and I'm going to say, "What's going on here?" And they're going to give me the exact same answer. They're going to both look at each other and go, "He," and blame the other one. Why am I going to ask the same question when I know I'm going to get the same answer? And this idea hit me. So I turned into their room and I said, "Hey, nobody talk. I'm about to ask a question." They both started going, "He," and I went, "Stop, nobody talk. Listen, I'm about to ask you in a minute what's going on here. You have to start, the first word out of your mouth has to be I. We're going to call it the I rule, and in this family, we're all going to start obeying the I rule. And you have to tell me everything you did, and once you finish that list, then you can tell me what your sibling did. All right? So we're going to start by owning our own side of the street. Then you can talk about their side of the street. Now, Reed, you're only 8 years old. You get to go first. Go. Tell me on what's going on here." And he went, "He." And I went, "I." And he. And I thought, he's taking Lamaze class. I mean, he was just, he. And he now was no longer mad at his older brother. Who do you think he was mad at? Yeah, he was just looking at me, he, and then he went, I was hit by him. And I started rolling. And I'm trying to keep a straight face, like, it's a teachable moment here. Let's get serious. But I started laughing. I thought, it's brilliant. He totally obeyed my rule and broke the spirit of it at the exact same time. It went from one little Pharisee to another. I just had to salute him. I was like, "Man, that's amazing." And I just go down and start laughing and tell Lisa what happened. The kids, now that they're in their 20s, they'll say, "Do you remember when Dad came up with that really lame eye rule?" Guess which two people in that household were the only two who got it? Lisa and me. So conflict occasionally comes up and it's like, "Huh, we got to talk about this. Let me go first. I was disrespectful to you. My tone, my words, you didn't deserve to be treated that way." But at the same time, because the I rule doesn't do denial. Denial's no good for any marriage. "Honey, but at the same time, this is what I sensed coming from you, and I just got to bring that to you at the same time." And see, it starts, loving confrontation always starts by looking at our own hearts first. Because how we confront doesn't just start with the heart, but even how we do it is also huge. Look at Ephesians chapter 4, verse 29. Ephesians 4, 29. It tells us, "Don't let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building up others according to" whose needs? Their needs. So even loving confrontation is done for the other person's good, that it may benefit those who listen. I still tell Lisa that the biggest and best gift she's ever given me came during a conflict years ago. I remember our kids were really young, so it had to probably be at least 20 years ago. I don't remember what the topic of the conversation was. I don't even know if while we were arguing, we remembered what the topic of conversation was. You know what I mean? You ever get in those arguments where you go, "What were we even arguing about?" We were now arguing about the way we were arguing. I remember I can even picture in that first home that we owned where we were standing in the kitchen. And I was giving one more point of exactly how right I was. I don't know what I was expecting from my wife. I think I was expecting at any moment she would go, "Oh my goodness, with that kind of data, now that you say it like that, your logic is so impeccable. I completely concede my case and yield the floor to you." But for some reason, she didn't have the wisdom to go there. And so I'm making my point, and she's making her point that doesn't sound at all like my point. And then, because she's wise enough to speak less than I do, She looked at me at one point and she said, "You know, Mark, you're not right, but you are better with words, so you're going to win another argument. What I need to know right now is, do you want to win at our marriage, or do you just want to win another argument?" And a gift was given. I was given the gift of actually seeing myself through her eyes, and I didn't like it. I saw a competitive young man who needed to be right and needed to be heard versus trying to understand where she was coming from and build oneness. Loving confrontation. Loving confrontation moves us to saying what needs to be said to build the other person up, even if it's hard words like I had heard from Lisa and have heard many, many times since then. But also how we say it is a big deal. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 15. "Instead, speaking the truth in love, we will grow up to become in every respect the mature body of him who is the head, that is Christ." In other words, we're going to grow up to start looking more like Jesus. How do we do it, he says? By speaking the truth in love. So if you're someone who tends to avoid conflict, you have to decide to speak the truth. Because for you, silence has not been so golden. It's just been a touch yellow-bellied. You know what I mean? We're avoiding conflict because we're afraid. But for you who are kind of conflict, you're attackers in conflict, we need to move speaking the truth in love. How we bring it will determine how we grow through it. And once we do that, once we committed to grow through conflict, not get around it, not get over it. Hey, can we just get over this so we can move on back to our marriage? And God is going, "No, this is your marriage. And I'm trying to use this episode of conflict actually as much as I'll use your best date night. They're both tools in my hands to grow you." And when we embrace that kind of loving confrontation, it moves us around to forgiveness. And again, staying in the book of Ephesians chapter 4, we read Paul say, "Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other, just as God in Christ forgave you." It's easy to say, forgiveness. Really hard to live. Colossians chapter 3, verse 13 is a parallel to this passage in Ephesians 4. Paul pushes it a little further. He says, "I want you to forgive each other for any grievance you have with each other, big or small, nagging or shattering." How in the world could God ask us of that? That's too big. That's too high and noble a calling. I think two little words in that verse help us see forgiveness for what it is and what it isn't. The two little words are the words "just as." We forgive just as God forgives us. And those two words change everything, because "just as" forgiveness helps us understand what real forgiveness is. And first of all, it helps us see what it's not. Real forgiveness is not pretending that something did not happen. That's just denial. That's just dismissal. And resolving conflict does not include denying or dismissing the wrongs that we've done to one another. How do we know that? Because Jesus didn't deny the wrongs that we did. And Jesus doesn't just dismiss the sin that we do. He didn't pretend that it didn't happen. No, forgiveness happens because he remembered that the sin happened and he died for it. He didn't deny it, he paid for it. And that also tells us that true forgiveness doesn't mean forgetting. You know, as a pastor, one of the things I hear the most when it comes to particularly serious infractions like broken vows in a marriage or repeated offenses, I'll hear one of the spouses say, "I'd like to forgive them, I really would, but I can't forgive them because I can't forget what they've done." And I don't say this patronizingly, but I usually will say, "That's good. Because at some point, you will have to remember if you're going to forgive them." You see, forgiveness means that we're releasing someone from a debt that they owe us. Could be an emotional debt. Could be a financial wound, a betrayal that's done. Could be a repeated words or sarcastic comments or neglect that happens over and over again. And it's created this emotional debt in the relationship. And forgiveness says, I'm releasing you from that debt. You cannot release somebody from a debt that you can't even remember that they owed. No, true forgiveness requires remembering at some level. In fact, God does not forget our sin. And hopefully some of you right now are going, wait a minute, Schatzman, you got to back off there. Because I seem to recall a verse in the Old Testament, it's there. In Isaiah that says, where God says, I remember your sin no more. Please don't ever misconstrue that to mean that he forget the sin actually ever happened. He's the omniscient God of the universe. He forgets nothing and sees everything. When he says, I remember your sin no more, what he's remembering saying is, I remember not only that you sinned, but I remembered that it was paid for. So I remember not to hold it over your head and hold that debt against you anymore. I'm remembering that my son has died for that, and your forgiveness stands in that remembrance, which also means that forgiveness is one of those things that happens because of the huge debt that Jesus Christ has paid, not just for us, but for our spouse. Someone has once said that the only man-made thing that will ever be in heaven is the scars of Jesus Christ, forever reminding us of two truths. We have sinned, and it has been paid for. And so when we forgive our spouse, we're forgiving out of remembering that, not the fact just that they have sinned. Just as forgiveness is also not an automatic cure for the hurt, how do we know? Well, when did Jesus say, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do? Yeah, on the cross. At the height of his pain is when he issued the forgiveness, which might mean you and I never look more like Jesus in our marriages than when we choose to forgive, even when we still feel the sting of the words or the neglect or whatever the action has been in your marriage. Someone has once said that a happy marriage is just the union of two good forgivers. And I think it's true. So the spouse who offended, in other words, the spouse who is wounded by word, by attitude, by action, we need to be responsible for seeking forgiveness. So we go to our spouse and we actually say, I was wrong. And then we get specific and ask for forgiveness. We don't go to them and say, if I hurt you, will you forgive me? We don't say to them, I was wrong and you have to forgive me. That's your job. I did my job. I asked you. Now you got to do your job. And we definitely don't go to them and say, I'm sorry, but you also did. Because that owns nothing. So we leave all ifs and ands and buts out of the equation. Because anytime we put those in, all we're doing now is we're seeking to justify ourselves and use religious language at the same time, which is called hypocrisy. And if you haven't noticed, by looking in the Gospels, hypocrisy never helped heal oneness. No, authentic seeking of forgiveness says, I own what I did in my word and in my attitude, in my action. And then the spouse who was offended must grant forgiveness. Must. Those aren't my words. Those are God's words. Whoever has an offense against the other, forgive them, just as God in Christ forgave you. I wish there was a shortcut. I really do. I wish there was a way we could walk the road of oneness and somehow take a shortcut around forgiveness. But there isn't, because the road of oneness is going to be, well, it's going to be the kind of road Jesus walked, and we call that a Calvary road, and there's no shortcut there. It's a road that leads to and through forgiveness. If we want a Christ-like marriage, if we want a divine portrait, God will give us many opportunities to forgive each other in little and big ways. But the good news is that we won't walk alone. God will meet us on that road. He won't just watch us do forgiveness. He'll actually instead step into our lives. He'll beat with our heart. He'll think with our mind. He'll love through our emotions. He'll even move through our actions, and he will give us the power to do what he has done for us. In fact, I actually believe that when we become married, we choose to forgive our spouse in obedience to God first and foremost. See, we don't forgive our spouse because we think they deserve it or because we think their apology was good or sincere enough. We forgive them because we see God in the middle of this marriage. In fact, my marriage to Lisa really has more to do for me with me and Jesus than it does me and Lisa. Lisa's marriage to Mark has more to do with Lisa and Jesus than it does Lisa and Mark. Meaning this, we choose to relate to one another even in conflict, even when it means extending forgiveness. Because of our relationship with God and what he's done. You know what he's asking me to do? When he asks me to forgive my spouse, all he's asking me to do is stop living like a hoarder. Somebody who has received massive loads of forgiveness and won't give a few ounces away. Or pounds away, if it's been a big offense. All God's asking us to do is receive and extend, and don't hold it to ourselves. And when we do that, it's the first step that he uses towards rebuilding trust. Again, I often hear that, Mark, I can't forgive my spouse because I can't trust them again. I mean, they've done this thing so repeatedly, or they've done this thing so massively that I just can't trust them. And until I can trust them, I can't forgive them. Listen, forgiveness and trust are connected. They're linked, but they are not the same thing. One is the cart and one is the horse. Forgiveness is the horse that pulls the cart of rebuilding trust. In fact, forgiveness must be done first, because if we don't forgive, we will be walking a path of bitterness, and bitterness will never rebuild trust. So if you are the spouse who has broken trust in small or large ways, you don't ever need to look at your spouse and say, hey, you said you forgave me, you just need to trust me from now on. No, that's not yours to demand. Trust is a gift they give, and you don't go demand birthday presents from your spouse, and at the same time, you don't go demand even a more priceless gift called trust. All you do every day is get up and live trustworthy. Live trustworthy. And over time, he or she will see that you are so trustworthy that they will start to extend, little by little bit, deposits of trust into this bank account of trustworthiness that you have built. Initially, they'll deposit small, 2-cent deposits. But over time, they'll begin to re-give their whole self. And likewise, for you who have had your trust broken, you're going to be tempted to tell your spouse that they have to earn your trust. And until they earn your trust, you will not give it. And I understand what you're saying, but I want to ask you to be careful. Because trust isn't earned, it's a gift you give. Now, they may have to live trustworthy over time to make it wise for you to redeposit your trust. But at some point, you will have to choose freely. They won't earn it. You will have to freely choose to redeposit your trust in them as they're trustworthy. And for that to happen, forgiveness will have to come first. Otherwise, bitterness will make it impossible and trust will continue, or mistrust will continue. So we move through this conflict loop. You've got this offense that happened. And the first thing you feel is anger over that. You pause and you say, what's going on inside? And once you see what the real emotion is underneath that, you're able to deal with your own heart and deal maybe with your spouse's heart a little better. And then you lovingly confront, or to say it a different way, you lovingly come together to dialogue through that issue. And I don't do denial, but we own our own stuff first and then begin to talk about the issue between each other. And once we define the issue or issues, the person who's done the offending, well, they seek forgiveness. The person who's been offended, will you grant forgiveness? And as you do that, we're then set up to close the loop on conflict. and bring it around to reconciliation, which is exactly where all of us want to be. Listen, in a room that's, what, 550 people full, we've got hundreds of opportunities for conflict, don't we? You'll have it before you come back here tomorrow morning. Some of those conflicts are small and nagging. You'll be able to quickly overlook, quickly maybe discuss it through, give forgiveness, and move forward. But some of those will be massive. Maybe vows have been broken. Maybe you're at a place where you just feel like it's irreconcilable. Can I tell you that reconciliation is possible for every single couple here? I believe it to the fiber of my being. Lisa and I have friends, good friends, who have broken vows massively and then reconciled their marriage through the process of forgiveness granted and trust rebuilt, and they are enjoying oneness in ways that should not have been possible because they walked that road of closing the loop. And on the other hand, we have good friends who chose to break their marriage all over a whole bunch of little things that they just let stack up over the years. So they finally just said, this feels too hard and it's not worth it, and they walked away. One chose to close the loop. The other one left so many little things open they couldn't even find their way forward anymore. Which one will we be? I stumbled across something a whole bunch of years ago written by Richard Halvorson. He's passed away now. He was the chaplain of the U.S. Senate. And he wrote this little piece called If You're Gonna Fight. He says, if you're gonna fight, fight for the relationship, not against it. Fight for reconciliation, not for alienation. Fight to preserve the friendship, not to destroy it. Fight to win your spouse, not to lose him or her. Fight to save your marriage, not to cash it in. Fight to solve the problem, not to salve your own ego. If you're going to fight to win, not to lose something that's too precious. Because lasting relationships are not negotiated, they're forged. And that will mean heat and pressure. It's a commitment to a relationship which sustains it, not pleasant feelings. So if you treat your relationship as negotiable, you will lose it. But if you consider it non-negotiable, you will find a way to make it work. And he closes this little piece by saying, authentic intimacy comes only through struggle. Can I say it a different way? Oneness happens even through conflict. It's true.